Yes.
When you say that you have that, what's sometimes called path moment of stream entry, you're out of space and out of time. Are you referring to, for instance, the kind of understanding of the unfabricated that's described in Visible called Ludescence, by Daryl Bailey, where he's basically describing how we delineate or sort of chop up what we see, what we hear, what we smell into sort of these things or concepts, and we fix them. And even though they're, you know, dependently originated and always changing, we, you know, sort of chop them up into things. That's a flower, that's a statue. And so we see them as unchanging, as it's no longer, you know, stream of dependently originated phenomena. So when we stop doing that, we in a sense no longer have the same perception of space, or, you know, we do the same thing temporally, so with regard to time as well, we'll sort of chop up our experience into the past, the present, and the future, and particular moments of the past and particular moments to come in the future. So all this sort of, you know, chopping up or delineating our experience into things that are fixed and no longer impermanent. When we stop doing that, in that sense, perhaps we're maybe out of space and out of time.
No, this is something really out of space, really out of time. And there's no contact with any of these things at all.
So you're no longer even taking in.
We're not even taking our sensory experience at all, definitely. And not even thoughts. And this is one of the reasons why it's important that you really get your mind well trained in concentration, because it's only in concentration that you can see the subtle fabrications that are still going on. And you know, even in the formless jhanas, it is possible for people, okay, they don't hear anything, they're not getting anything through the five senses, but there's still activity in the sixth sense. And then when you're the experience of awakening, okay, even that sixth sense is, you're not really taking anything at all. There's no activity there at all. So it's really outside. Because mm-hmm. When you get into these come to these formless states, it is possible to just see, okay, I'm just with the awareness and everything else is just flowing. And that's a very subtle, strong state of concentration, but it's not awakening. Yes?
Two questions. First, following that, when you're there, what happens to your body, your form?
You're not aware of it.
Okay, but the form of the body maintains itself. Mm-hmm. It's the awareness that is formless.
Right.
Gotcha. Second, on page 14 of the Four Noble Truths, is, and monks, as long as this, my three-round, 12 permutation knowledge, what does that refer to, three-round, 12 permutation?
Okay. We've got plenty of time. I keep forgetting that we're on a 12 o'clock. Three rounds, 12 permutation. You've got four noble truths, right? You have three levels of knowledge for each truth. And the three levels of knowledge are: one, you know the truth. Two, you know the duty with regard to that truth. And three, you realize you have completed that duty. Four times three is 12. That's why the correct Dharma wheel has 12 spokes.
Not eight for the eight.
Oh. Get one of your artists to work on that.
So I had a question about clinging and fabrication. So in order for clinging to happen, fabrication has to happen first.
Well, it's the clinging that drives the fabrication.
Okay, so clinging.
And clinging, of course, is a kind of passion.
Okay.
Clinging is defined as passion and desire. And it's, when you think about it, okay, you're fabricating your experience while you're doing it because you want something. And you see that all the activity, effort that goes into the fabrication is worth it because what you're going to get out of the fabrication is going to more than make up for the effort that goes into it. And a lot of this is seeing, okay, it's not worth it. I've had pizza before, and I've had pizza before, and I've had pizza before, and maybe all that effort going down to the pizza parlor. But what's special here is that you're actually, you know, you're fabricating your own experience of the six senses. And when there's no more passion for that, the fabrication just kind of, like, the fabrication energy runs out. This is how awakening can happen.
So just not believing the fabrications
are worth it.
Right, okay.
Now, in the meantime, before you get there, however, you have to believe that it's worth fabricating the path. Because you can't just lie down here in the room and campaign, that's it. Scrape me off the floor. It doesn't work that way. As long as there's some part of you that said there's still something needs to be, I want to get out of this. And so you have to learn how to take that apart actively. So you have to fabricate the path in order to do that. This is where so much effort has to go into sitting and meditating and all the other practices.
Yeah. You've mentioned jhanas a few times, mm-hmm. and I'm curious, is it important to like study and attempt to pursue different levels of jhana, or is that something that just kind of comes naturally through meditation?
Well, I'd qualify the distinction there. It is something you want to pursue. Now, one of the worst ways you can pursue it is to say, okay, there are five factors in the first jhana, let's get all five factors together. It's like saying, durian smells horrible, and it has this funny taste, but it's got a lot of healthy oils, and it's got vitamin E, and it's got cyanide, a lot of potassium. So you put all those things together. Are you going to get durian? No. Well, the way you do it is you focus, I think John Lee's instructions on jhana are, I think, the best out there. Focusing on the breath, working with the breath energy, using your directed thought to work with the sense of pleasure that arises from being with the breath. And as you focus on the breath in those ways, then the jhanas come. Let's look at a few of the readings. Okay, the readings on the First Noble Truth. I just want to make one very long, or very, very, one very, very general comment about this. Birth, aging, illness and others. Birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, despair, distress, association with the unbeloved, separation from the beloved. The Buddha's just giving examples here. Socrates would pull out his hair. Because for Socrates, the definition means you have to define the essence of the sun. The Buddha's not talking about the essence here yet. He's just giving you examples. You get a general idea of what he's talking about.
Could you tell us?
We're on page 3 and page 4. The definitions there are pretty self-explanatory. What is lamentation? Whatever crying, grieving, lamenting, weeping, wailing, and lamentation. Okay, we get that. Pain is the bodily discomfort. Distress is the mental discomfort. Association of the beloved, separation from the beloved, not getting what is wanted. That one has an interesting definition. Being subject to birth, the wish arises. Oh, may we not be subject to birth, and may birth not come to us, but this is not to be achieved by wishing. Never, whatever it is that you might wish for, but wishing is not going to get you, that's suffering. and particularly the things about aging, illness, and death, sorrow, limitation, despair. We're getting more into the mental side now of the suffering. Okay, these things are happening, we just don't want them to happen, and we wish they would stop. But wishing is going to be the wrong way. The Buddha has a similar statement about prayer. He says, if you throw a boulder into the water, you get lots of people to come around and say, oh, rise, oh boulder, and pray and pray and pray. Is the boulder going to come up? No. You break open a jar of ghee on the water, which is going to float on the water. And you get a group of people together and curse the ghee and say, go down, ghee, is it going to go down? No. It's just it's not that much that prayer can. Prayer can achieve. I must admit, I'm still amazed at the amount of prayer that goes into sports contests. You know, why God would want one side to win and the other side to lose, I just have no idea. Is there anything in that passage on the first noble truth that you'd like to have discussed further? Okay. Notice that it's the clinging aggregates that are stressful, not the aggregates themselves. There's a lot of confusion on this. I've actually read scholarly books where they got that wrong. It's the clinging that actually turns these things into stress. The origination of stress, the B there in the middle of page 4. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passions of light, relishing now here, now there, sensuality craving, becoming craving, and non-becoming craving. That's the general discussion that we had just now about what kind of craving. Notice it is specifically it's the kind of craving that makes for further becoming. Now the desire to be on the path doesn't count. I mean, there may be some stress around that, but that actually comes under the fourth noble truth. And then it goes into a very long discussion of where the craving arises and whatever is enduring and alluring in terms of the world. That is where this craving, when arising, arises. That is where when dwelling, it dwells. Okay, it's the things in the world. And the world here refers to the six senses. Anything that you find enduring and alluring, that's where the craving is going to arise. So that's where you've got to watch out for it. And here, there's a long list. There's first you have the six senses, then you have the objects of the six senses. Consciousness at the six senses, contact, feeling born of that contact. Perceptions around the objects, your intentions for these things. You can actually have craving for craving. We all know that one. Thought directed at forms, okay, this is worth getting into verbal fabrications here. The directed thought and the evaluation of these things. This is where your craving can center on any of these things. The third noble truth basically says okay, that wherever it arises, that's where you try to abandon it. If you notice craving arises out of form, you have to look at the form in such a way so as to buff it, so as to get rid of that craving. Wherever there's craving for a particular sound or for a particular thought, you have to look at that thought so there is no craving for it. That's getting into passage C. What is the noble truth of the cessation of stress? Remainderless fading, then cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that craving. So wherever you notice it arising, and this is where you have to be very careful. People going to say, okay, I know the craving is a problem, so I'm just not going to crave. But you're not really watching carefully. Where is it arising? What specifically? Where are your particular cravings? You want to notice those. You want to be clear about it so you can actually watch it happen.
I don't get that exactly.
You don't get that? Okay. Okay. You say, sit down, class, and explain to me where the, you know, what's the cause of suffering? Okay, after this morning's discussion, we can all say the three forms of craving. Now, do you actually see it happening in your mind? Do you see yourself thirsting for certain things? Okay. And can you actually say, okay, I'm going to look at that thing to the point where I don't thirst for it anymore?
That's part I don't get.
That's the part I don't get. That's why we have a path, because you can't just do it right there. You need to develop a path, which is what I hope we're going to be spending a fair amount of time on that, because it requires a fair amount of time of discussion. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you want to develop the factors of the path so that when you look at a particular perception that you enjoyed before, you realize, I don't want that either. I've outgrown that. And it's not so much aversion. John Cha has a nice word. He says it's sobering up. You know, I was intoxicated with this, and now that I actually really look at it, I don't really want it anymore. There's a passage in the canon where the Buddha talks about a blind man who's given a dirty rag. He's told, this is a nice white piece of cloth, clean and beautiful. Take care of it. So he takes care of the rag, thinking that it's a nice white piece of cloth. And then he finally gets cured of his blindness, and the first thing he does, he looks at the cloth, and he goes, oh my gosh, this is a dirty rag. They lied to me. He says, this is what an awakened person feels about with the five aggregates. I thought this was just all this wonderful stuff, and it's not. There's something better. And again, it's not just telling yourself this is bad and I got not like it. You really do find something better than this, and then you look back at this and say, "Well, that was delusion."
So, Ginger, mm-hmm. I have a question about looking at and seeing. So, we'll go back to the pizza, which is easy because I don't like pizza. So, okay, but I see a piece of
like?
Pizza, and I want what?
What do you like?
I see a piece of pizza and I like it. And I think, okay, you know, trying to work with the Four Noble Truths, what I'm wondering is if I really look, can I see the suffering in that wanting? So how do you decide whether to say I could look at all the downsides of pizza or I could really try and explore the suffering that I'm experiencing? The sort of subtle levels of why this ultimately isn't very happy.
Okay, you do both together.
Okay.
Because as you're saying, you know, pizza is basically grease. it's got a lot of carbohydrates and all these other things that I don't want. And you go down the list and there'll be another part of the mind that says, but I want it anyhow. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, why? And you say, because. But it doesn't say, because why. It just says, because. And you say, no, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to go down and buy the pizza until you give me a reason. And it'll come up with a little bit of a reason. After a while. You don't see the desire clearly until you thwart it. Basically what it comes down to.
Right, I definitely understand.
And then once you've thwarted it, then you begin to see then you see that, you know, the desire is a lot of suffering.
Right.
But it's not just that the fact that it's suffering, you're saying, what is there behind this? And you see, okay, there's a perception. Oh, there's a thought, or there's an evaluation, any of this directed thought evaluation kind of stuff behind there that's giving you the reasons. Right. Mental fabrication, verbal fabrication, it's giving you the reasons. And you realize, okay, that's dumb.
I don't have to cook.
You don't have to cook. Lots of other things you can buy where you don't have to cook either.
And that's what my company likes. I mean, I have reasons why I buy a pizza. I don't really like it, but I do buy it.
Buy it. But there has to come a point where you say, okay, if it were just me on my own tonight at the dinner table, I'd have to worry about my company. You wouldn't buy it.
I don't like it.
Then the question is, okay, what do you really like? Because you've got to see the craving only at spots where you really like it. This is why I'm frustrated with this pizza example.
I'll eat my leftovers in the refrigerator.
Okay. I eat anything easy. Thing is, there has to be something there where you don't have a very strong desire. You're not going to see it clearly, but if there's a really strong desire, that's when you say, got to focus on this and understand what it is. And you'll see, on the one hand, the stupidity or the reason behind it, you also see the irritation and the frustration of not getting it. That's when you begin to say, okay, that desire really is something I don't want to go with anymore. It's not worth it. Because there's a lot of fabrication that goes into that. You know, we talked earlier about how, you know, it's the fabrication where all the energy goes. And the Buddha lists these, in perception, feeling, directed thought, and evaluation. These are all kinds of fabrication. And our craving goes for the fabrication. Yes?
I was actually wondering if you could just sort of continue walking us through that particular example with respect to perception and attention and directed thought and evaluation. Just sort of give us a sense for, you know, how you would work really thoroughly through this particular
example. Okay, let's stick with the pizza. Okay, your perception of pizza as flavorful. And you might want to change the perception. Is that most store-bought pizza, or especially chain pizza, has all these chemicals that you wouldn't, you know, want to ever have go near you. And that's what the flavor is made up out of. One of my students was looking at a documentary recently at a Swiss company that creates natural flavors. And what they do is that they take a natural flavor and they tweak it. They make it sharper. They make it shorter lasting, so you're not satisfied. And then they go and they put that in your pizza. Okay, so if you can change your perception around the flavor, that's really something desirable. So, I don't know, those chemicals are kind of scary. Your direct thought and evaluation, pizza's easy. Yeah. All I have to do is just go down the store, I don't have to cook. And then you can say, well, wait a minute, let's think a little bit further about that. It might be easy right now, but all those chemicals I'm getting in my body, I may have to flush those chemicals out sometime, or deal with the, you know, physical ravages of the chemicals. So again, you're changing your perception, you're changing the way you're thinking around the pizza. But first you've got to think, there's something about it that's attracting me. An easier example is a BMW. You talk about all, you know, how stylish the BMW is, and people are going to look at you as you drive down the road, you're driving in your BMW, and they're going to be jealous, and you're just so happy that they're going to be jealous. And then you have to look at that. Okay, wait a minute, do I really want to feed on that kind of stuff? That's pretty miserable. So you have to look at what it is about the object that you find attractive. And, okay, is it actually in the object, or is it in your perception of the object? Is it in the way you evaluate, the way you talk to yourself about the object? Just the gut feeling that arises around the object. And then say, okay, what's really attractive about that? These are just thoughts, these are just perceptions. The reality has very little to do with them. Yes.
So we're looking for sustenance.
We're looking for sustenance, and then you're trying to ask yourself, is this really satisfying?
None of it is. This is what you start to find out, that there isn't any sustenance in all of that. And then that's what the Dharma is for.
The Dharma is for, that's also what concentration practice is for. To give you a sense of, okay, at least I'm getting nourished with the stillness of my mind.
So you find the nourishment there.
Right. Instead of pulling away, instead of running after all these other things.
In the Second Noble Truth, when he starts listing what's endearing and alluring in terms of the world, the first thing is the eye is endearing and alluring in terms of the world, and, you know, eye consciousness and eye contact come later. But starting with the eye itself.
Because you really enjoy the ability to see things. You really enjoy the ability to hear.
It doesn't need an object to...
No, well, you're not just... you know that you, because you have this ability, then you're going to be able to attain the objects. It's how you attach to the senses. Yeah.
So you nourish yourself with practice. To what end?
To the end of getting the mind to a point where it doesn't need feeding anymore, because it's so satisfied.
So the mind is satisfied.
Right.
And once the mind is satisfied?
You can go anywhere you like. Mm-hmm. You can go anywhere you like.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch it.
You can go anywhere you like. Oh. The Buddha's done with you.
Thank you. And so where do I go from here?
First you got to get there.
And how do I get there from here?
Okay, that's what we're talking about. You work on the path.
I'm wondering if you have thoughts about this kind of noticing, the disillusionment with what previously caught you and hooked you is not so appealing, really. That kind of disillusionment and what some people might call depression, where things of the world lose their appeal.
Okay, we're dealing with it in two layers. One is, if you gain awakening, you found something that's so good that you don't really care about the rest anymore. That's not depression.
No.
At all. Now, there is this sense that it comes on us. In fact, this is what came on the Buddha when he was still a young prince, saying, this is not worth it. But he hadn't found a way out. And so it was... Until he found a way out, there was a very strong depression, right? A very strong sense of despair. But he always had the hope, okay, there must be a way out. This is what I always find inspiring in his story, that he never gave up. There's got to be a way out. He kept looking for it. I mean, he did all the 6 years of torture. That didn't work. Prior to that, he'd done all these refined meditations, just staying in concentration. That hadn't worked. We kept thinking there must be a way out. It was that determination to keep finding the way out. That's what differentiates it from depression. Depression is convinced there's no way out. Just kind of gives up. And in Pali, they talk about Sanvega as being a sense of kind of overwhelming. They actually call it terror. That's one of the most literal translations of Sanvega. It can also be a sense of dismay, a sense of urgency. I got to get out of here. And it has to be paired with basada, which is the conviction that there's a way out. Otherwise, some way on its own gets very depressing. I have a student down in San Diego. She was involved in a car accident. She killed the guy. And she's been in one, dealing with the law, and two, dealing with some severe depression. And she called me up. She'd been talking to her psychiatrist. The psychiatrist is telling you, I've come to the conclusion that your life really isn't worth living anyhow. He's saying, this guy should have his license removed. It's not something you say to someone who's suffering from severe depression. So we had a long talk.
So your examples of craving were BMW and pizza, but what if your craving is basically healthy? It's the craving itself. I mean, so you're craving kale or salad.
Well, then you have to look at it and say, do I want to just spend the rest of my life eating kale? Because I'm better than kale.
An awful lot of time dealing with the noise and that, working with the skillful thinking and the analyzing of the pizza and all of that stuff. And I guess I just wonder, I guess it's necessary, but
you've got to rest.
Don't you get to a point, I mean,
you've got to rest. And so you can't just keep asking these questions all the time. And you say, okay, if I'm getting an answer, I'll go for the answer. If the answer's not coming, I'm just going to be quiet.
I mean, basically, I'm hungry. I'm being biological. Okay, so, all right. Now, I'm just here.
and then the time being is, okay, how can I, what, this is where you bring in the questions about, okay, if I want to eat, why am I going to eat? Is it just keep my body alive so I can continue practicing? That's okay. And I have nothing against pizza, if that's what you want. The issue is, if I'm sitting here meditating, all I can think about is the pizza, then you've got a problem.
Right, then you're clinging.
Okay. And then there are times when you know you've got a particular kind of clinging and you can't see through it. You say, well, I've just got to get my mind quiet first. And then pose the question again, or think of another way of posing the question. But okay, you go back and forth between getting the mind quiet and then asking the question and then seeing if there's an answer. Ask it a couple times, and then you can't see through it, said my concentration isn't strong enough. Go back to concentration.